And it's not, well, I'm going to hear it and then everything's going to be okay. That isn't the way it goes. Like, hopefully we can find something that we can start to do. Like, bring God into the picture. You know, we have a young man at my group. We forget some of this simple stuff. This isn't rocket science, but it is spiritual truth. And spiritual truth doesn't do you a damn bit of good with me standing up here talking. It's what you take, and I'm going to try and be as practical as I can. Little thing like saying, God, I know you're here, whether you believe it or not. God, I know that you're here. Come with me. Show me the way. And keep saying that kind of stuff. Because there's no way that the earthly world is going to change automatically because I'm unhappy with it. Or I need something. Or I want something. That isn't how it works. It's from the inside out. Take a look at what's going on in here. Take a look at what your attitudes are. And if you think the outside has got to change, that's not how it goes. There was no amount of crying and carrying on that kept me from Skid Row for a whole year. And there were days when I didn't have food and just kept doing the things I had to do. You know, I think this, you know, just simply remembering, God, I know that you're here. It's amazing how it changes the way we think. And things that we didn't see before, our mind opens up. How else is it going to happen? See? Do something for somebody else. See, on the farm, we used to have a pump, and it needed to be primed. And that meant to get water out of it, you had to pour water into it, and then you pumped a bit, and then that would wet the washers or whatever, and water would come out. You know, you can smile at somebody. You can do something nice for somebody and not be found out. God, the world is full of opportunities to say something nice to people, or, you know, to hold open a door for somebody. And if you do it from God consciousness, and I don't care if you believe in it or not, take a look around at the people who are here. Take a look around at the people you've seen at the program. You know, spirituality, that you don't get to see it first. You have to do it, and then you get to see it. And one of the ways, if you feel that you're in lack and whatever, you can't tell me anything about that. I know what it feels like to be at home and look in the fridge and there's nothing there and know that there's no money to buy anything, and it didn't kill me, and I lived through it. And, you know, so my heart goes out to you, anybody that's in difficulty. I'm in difficulty, for God's sake. You know, not the way you dirty-minded people think, either. Pardon me? What did you say? At 51 years sober? But, you know, I think some of that is like priming the pump. Like somebody, I often tell sponsees, go to a volunteer organization. Go do something for somebody. You'd be amazed at how sometimes a job develops out of that. Anyway, that isn't really what I wanted to talk about. Let's ask God. I know what I wanted to say. God, you know, sometimes you get messages from people. About 2 weeks ago, we were doing step two at my home group discussion meeting. And one of the young guys that I really like, you're not the only one, honey. Anyway, he was talking about how he'd been on the bus that night, and he said, you know, I found myself sitting there, and he said, I found myself becoming more and more angry. And he said, I found myself becoming more and more angry, and I'm saying, why am I so angry? I'm not usually this angry. And some woman was on her cell phone, and he said, I realized something. I always, before I leave the house, ask God to come with me. And he said, I forgot to do that tonight. And I was on my own. And you know what? If we're on our own, God help us. Let's ask God to come with us. And so let's ask God to be with us in this half hour, three quarters of an hour, where we're going to start talking about the love of my life, step one. And so, God, please open our minds and our hearts so that we can hear what it is that we need to hear, because you are the teacher. And this deal is not between Mildred and anybody. It's between God and the soul, whatever, whoever you are. I am willing to hear what you would speak to me, and I will say whatever it is that I feel is necessary. Amen. I'd like to start out with something I love. It's called God Speak to Me. The man whispered, God, speak to me. And a meadowlark sang, but the man did not hear. So the man yelled, God, speak to me! And the thunder rolled across the sky, but the man did not listen. The man looked around and said, God, let me see you. And a star shined brightly, but the man did not notice. And then he shouted, God, show me a miracle if you are there. And a life was born, but the man did not recognize what had happened. So the man cried out in despair, touch me, God, and let me know that you are here. Whereupon God reached down and touched the man. But the man brushed the butterfly away and walked on in despair. So, if you look at the steps, if I have something to write, I like to draw a big arch. Because where do we start this process of the steps? We started, do we not, with powerlessness. And where does that arch take us? The sweep of those 12 steps take us to a spiritual awakening, which is everything. You know, and I know you can say everything. I need money. I need a man. I need a woman. I need God knows what. And what we really need is the spiritual awakening to see the world different. You know, I read you that little piece from Carl Jung where he said, you know, attendance at a church did not necessarily provide the whatever it takes for God's grace to come in. Why? Because I believe that we have to be knocked to our knees to see something. The best thing that ever happened to me was the morning of May the 20th when I couldn't figure out one solitary thing that I could do to make my life better. I had manipulated and used and abused and hurt people and behaved so badly that nobody would let me anywhere near them. And I couldn't think of one way that I could get off the street and stop selling my body and all the stuff that went with that. And so I decided to take my life. Now that may seem like not a very good prayer. I think it's a most beautiful prayer. Because when we get to the point where we can say, I don't know how, that's when God can rush in. I think often that's why when we say, God help me, I need to get sober, it doesn't happen because it's all about me. I want to feel better. And when I don't have anything left, when I am completely stripped, That's when the universe can roll in. I'm not one who believes that God lets some people get sober and not others. And I hear people say, I'm so blessed God let me get sober. I don't believe that. We don't understand the workings of the soul. What we see on the outside and what we say on the outside is not necessarily what's going on in here. God knows your soul, like a young man said to me. Woke up one night morning on the floor of the place where he was. Thank you, darling. That's a nice thing for a 51-year-old to do. I'm watching. We'll get it undone. Where was I? The young man on the floor. And he said he woke up in his own vomit and his own urine and God knows what. And he said there was a 40-ounce bottle of vodka within reach. And he said, I looked at it, and something in me said, you're done. And he was done. You see, we don't understand the human, you know, what's really going on inside. I certainly don't. And that morning, I wouldn't have said, it didn't hit me for a lot of years what really happened that morning. If anybody had said, what do you think happened? I wouldn't have known what to say. I think I was touched by God, absolutely. And I believe if you're alcoholic the way I'm alcoholic, if you're sitting here tonight and you do not have the compulsion and the obsession, then how dare you say that you have not been touched by God and that you are not touched by God right now. Right now. Because the compulsion and the obsession, as I've experienced it, it gave me no peace. And that morning when it was taken in a heartbeat. And I was a changed person. And I remember standing there in the room saying, I don't know what's going on here, and I don't know who you are, but I don't know how to live sober, and you'll have to send me somebody, and I will obey. And as I said it, there was a rap on the door, and a man stood there offering help. You tell me that that is all. And I often say to people, look at your own experience. You know, I don't have a God of my understanding, because my intellect is puny. How in the name of heaven would I have a God of my understanding and I can't even figure out a computer or whatever? You know? What I have is a God of my experience. And the God of my experience, when I get out of the way, does for me that which I cannot do for myself. And I know that when I am resisting, I'm in a situation now, it's a legal situation, so I can't talk about it, but I have a lot of fear around it. And I have to tell you that I'm doing the work. And one of these days, you know, I'd like to say, oh yeah, I've surrendered. I'm this and I'm that. No, I'm not. I'm still afraid. And I'm still afraid of a person. And I know where the work has to be, and when I no longer have it, you keep doing the work until it goes. Anyway, step one. I think until that point comes, and that's what I think is the gift of alcoholism. It opens us up to a whole new spiritual way of life. That's really what the deal is. You know, Bill says it. He says alcohol is the symptom. Well, if it's the symptom, I guess it's not the problem. See, I think, of course, it creates problems, but I think it works like this. We're here to express the God within us. And it's just like when you use an object. Let's say you take an egg beater. and you try and mix cement with it, you're going to break the egg beater. The egg beater is going to be very unhappy. And so when we use this precious gift of life that we are, if indeed you believe, I can't believe for you, but I believe that God is appearing to be Mildred, and that it's my job to express that. I didn't always believe that, but I do now. And if I don't do that, then I'm like the egg beater beating cement. And that's the way I was. 5 years of age. I'm unhappy because I have a retarded sister and I can't fix it. And nobody else seems to fix it. And so I'm unhappy and I pick up a drink at five and the magic happens. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't have to slip into alcoholism. I got that magic feeling where I loved you, you loved me, and everything was good. And that's what I chased for 35 years. And the problem with it, I think, is this. That's why I started out by talking about the thirst. By talking about, over the centuries, how this has been the subject of mankind suffering, feeling empty inside, feeling all kinds of pain and suffering, and not recognizing that it is the thirst for God. And so, I think that pain is talking to us. When I think of the people who have talked at meetings, I have never in my 37 years heard anybody start talking in AA that they didn't say something like this: I didn't fit. I didn't feel okay. I felt something was wrong. I was shy. Something. Isn't that true? What did we do about it? One day, took a drink. Somehow or other, that happened. And we were off to the races, because that drink does for us what it doesn't do for those Al-Anons who take one little sip and say, I'm starting to feel it. I've got to stop. I've got to go home and cut the grass. Well, the problem, I think, is this. That pain inside is pushing on us to do something to grow in God consciousness, and we misinterpret. You know, I think of the fire alarm. A fire alarm is useful. The fire alarm goes off, and it's telling you something. It's saying, there's danger here. You know, take care of business. Get out of here so you don't get fried. Our pain, I think, is telling us something. It's saying something to us. There's something wrong with the way you live. As Chuck said, we run out of time. But do we listen? Uh-uh. We take that drink and we shut down the pain. That's the problem. And instead of growing in God consciousness, we stay stuck. And through the process of drinking, because it does for us what it does for us, we spiral down to that place called bottom. And bottom is not a physical place. It's a place where the soul says, I've had enough. And the book says we reach a turning point. And now, am I going to accept spiritual help? Or am I going to go to the bitter end? I've seen it. You've seen it. Not too long ago, we had a young man sit in front of a train. This is a messy business. You know, I sat with somebody who had been sober 18 years and watched that person die because he couldn't get whatever it was that he needed. See, that turning point does not guarantee. Like when I came in 1966, I had all the qualifications. I had reached a bottom. I certainly needed help, but I could not make the choice for the spiritual. I came into AA, and when in 3 weeks I wasn't transformed, I got stoned. And I sat in AA stoned for 5.5 years, and that isn't the smartest thing I've done either. And, you know, then I left and, you know, I drank. My father had said, you get transformed in AA, because my brother went to AA and my father said he's transformed. And I was waiting to be transformed. I didn't know who was going to do it, and I didn't know how it was going to happen. 3 weeks was long enough, and I couldn't stand it. I could always get sober. I just couldn't stay sober because I felt so bad inside. You know, sometimes people say, well, I can't identify. Identification is not about how much you drank, where you drank, how much you puked, etc., 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 how long you drank, what you drank. I don't think that can be a point of connection, but once that connection is made, I think the real business is what is going on in here and the things that we couldn't deal with that were going on in here and that I had to drink to make the pain go away. That's the problem, you see, and that's why we're powerless. See, once I have gone down that road, when I have spiraled down to what we call bottom, I'm beyond human aid. And the next thing I think that happens is some people come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And if they're somebody catches them and says, all you have to do is don't drink and go to meetings, what's getting taken care of? I've seen this, where people come in, they go to meetings, they run with a crowd, they bathe once in a while, they brush their teeth, they get some clean clothes, they get a job, and they get some money. And they call that recovery. And before too long, they're out the door. Or they stay in the program and do not continue to enlarge their spiritual life. And you know what happens? All the stuff that was there before they took that first drink comes roaring right back into their lives. You see? And what do you do with all that? You see? I love language. And language talks to me. I'm sure it talks to every one of you. What does that word powerless really get to? See, I think that is the door that leads us to the rest of the steps. You know, we have a guy at my group, and he keeps saying, I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over alcohol. I know that. I know that if I were to take a drink, I am back, that there's no end. I know what the book says. You know, Dr. Silkworth said, we have something in our bodies, and that has been shown to be the case, that we don't process alcohol the way other people do. And it sets up that craving, which becomes then that compulsion and that obsession, and we're off to the races. Absolutely. We have to be abstinent if we're going to do the work of change. If I'm going to deal with everything that was in my life, all those old belief systems, I'm nothing and I'm not important and nobody listens to me when I want them to fix Dora and all that kind of stuff. If I'm going to deal with all that stuff, because that's the stuff that's it at the bottom of some of my bad behavior, some of the way I deal with people, that's where it is. And so if I'm going to deal with that, I've got to be sober. Because if I continue to deaden the pain, I can't do that. And, you know, I think it's really interesting to me that the first 50 pages of this book, we have to the end of step 11 is 88 pages, and then we have the 7 pages, let's say, from the doctor's opinion. So we've got about 95 pages, and 50 pages of that are on step 1. what are those pages about? To me, it's like a kaleidoscope, collage. When I got back from Egypt some years ago, I made a collage. You know what a collage is? You take a picture of being on the Nile, and you take a picture of the pyramids, and you take a picture of Moses the camel, and you take a picture of all kinds of things, and you put it together. And anybody that looks at that gets a feeling for it. You tell me that I'm powerless, I go brain dead. Yeah, I know I'm powerless. And you can keep saying that to me. But this 50 pages, it talks to me. Because it's like a collage. We start out with the doctor's opinion. And good Dr. Silkworth, God bless him, I think he played a big role. Because he was the one who defined the fact there's something wrong with our bodies. You know, and that wasn't known before. And the medical profession sure didn't want to hear that. And he was the one also that said, frothy emotional appeal won't work. This is too ingrained. If I have the compulsion to drink, you can sit and cry all you like, and you can tell me all the damage I'm going to do. I don't hear that because I am now going to drink. Because the compulsion and the obsession is upon me. And so he goes on to say, you know, we doctors, we don't know. We think that some moral stuff would be good for these people, but we don't know how to do this. Then we get Bill's story. And Bill tells us that, you know, what happened to him. And how, you know, there were times when he thought, I've got it now. And then he'd find himself on the bar, beating on the bar one more time, saying, how did this happen? And he'd find himself taking money out of Lois's purse and feeling like the lowest of the low, and he couldn't stop. See? How does that get interrupted? If you have worked with alcoholics, you know what that feeling is like. I am so grateful that I came in a time before there were treatment centers, and we went on wet 12-step calls. Isn't that true? And that's where you really got the feeling. And I'm not saying that people don't do that, but we don't do that as much anymore. And, you know, Bill really lays out his despair and then what he had to do. And that whole story of how Ebby came to see him. And I think it's just God's activity at work. Then we get to the chapter, There Is a Solution. See, every one of these chapters gives us something else. And there we have that, The Common Solution. I love that title. Just think if you know, you were sick, very, very ill, and somebody said, I have a solution for you. You know, you go to some meetings and you do a few things and you have a solution for what's wrong with you. And that's what he says. We get into that chapter, and on page 19, 21, he says, what about the real alcoholic? I had four brothers, and one of them was alcoholic, and the other one that I'm talking about, he was not alcoholic. You know, he would drink, he'd be so drunk he could hardly walk, and if he had work to do the next morning, he was there. I remember one of the first times I was teaching again, and we'd had a staff party, and my boss was at that party, and he was so drunk he could hardly walk. And I fully expected the next morning he wouldn't be at work. I got there early, and there he was sitting at his desk, bright-eyed. See, he wasn't an alcoholic. And he says, if a sufficiently strong reason comes up, becomes operative, if you're not a real alcoholic, you can stop. So, he talks about losing control. But what I really like is page 23, where he says, The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And one time I was talking at a convention, and one of the old-timers took me aside because I guess I was giving the impression I didn't think that applied to me. What I was using mind as was intellect. I'm smart, so doesn't apply to me. And this old-timer took me aside and says, this has nothing to do, honey, with your intellect. It has to do with your inner world, your values, your old ideas, your memories, your beliefs. That stuff that churns in here, that stuff that hurts so much that one day you just say, that's it, I need a drink to make, I can't breathe. Isn't that true? It's right there. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And there we have it again. Just physical abstinence won't do it. It's a good place to start, but it takes... That's the basis on which we can do the rest of the work. Then on page 24, there's a statement which I always like to comment on with sponsees. He says here, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. See, on page 43, he says, there are days, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Well, I think he's implying there, if I can say no to a drink today because I don't have the compulsion and the obsession. But if I had the compulsion and the obsession, I couldn't say no to the drink. I have no effective mental defense. And I want to say that because, and it says, we have lost the power of choice in drink. See, I had a young woman call me one day. She said, she's from my group, and though I don't sponsor her, she said, I just wanted to hear your voice. She was at a business luncheon, and the red wine was starting to look very good to her. And she said, I just wanted to hear your voice. I wasn't there, so she left a message. So the next time we were at a meeting together, I said to her, how did all that work out? And she said, well, after I phoned you, she said, I felt okay and I didn't drink. And something motivated me. I said, did you get on your knees and pray? And she looked stunned. She said, no, I did what they told me to do. They told me to call somebody. Well, I can tell you, when I got sober, they made it very clear to me that I had lost the power of choice in drink and that there are days on which the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink, which means, where am I going to go? To my knees to ask God, because the book is clear. I love these pages because it says it over and over and over again. No human power can fix me, and I can't fix myself, and I've lost the power of choice. And I think we need to tell young people or our new people that, because she didn't know. She thought she was doing what she should do. I said, pray first, then phone. That's the right order. Get on your knees, ask the power, because the book says it. I'm not going on what I think. I'm going on what the book says. You've lost the power of choice in drink if that compulsion comes up. And I think of one of our old-timers, and I won't mention his name because that's... But I do know his story. At 35 years sober, and he's as active as I am or Bob or anybody who's really active. And he was 35 years sober at the time. And he was sitting in an airplane. And the booze can came out. You know, they used to have a different kind of structure. It had a little wagon. And he said, instantaneously, out of nowhere, it seemed to him, He had the most god-awful compulsion to pick up a drink. He was on his way to speak at a conference. And he said, while part of me was saying, you mustn't do this, the other part of him was reaching into his pocket, as he used to do for years and years, picking out some money and putting it in his breast pocket so he'd be ready. And he said he was five rows back, and he said, I prayed. I prayed. And he said, by the time she came, he said, the compulsion was gone. And he said, I thought of all the times that I had prayed, all the times that I had been of service to somebody, all the times that I had read this and that I understood. I couldn't help myself in that instant. And he said, I realized my suit was wringing wet. In that very short time, something really dramatic. I was so glad that he had told that story. Because, you know, who's to say that any one of us couldn't have that happen to us, that the compulsion. I can tell you, I took it very, very seriously and realized I better be very smart. You know, the book says we have a daily reprieve dependent on our spiritual condition. Anyway, he says we are without defense against the first drink if that compulsion comes up. So then, he goes on to say, there is a solution. You notice he doesn't say it's going to meetings. I love meetings, but they have a purpose. He says here, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching. Who likes to do that? The leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. And it's in that part that he says, we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. What does that mean? Obviously, here I am, I'm going out to commit suicide, and the next minute, I'm over here, not physically. But isn't that what a rocket does? It moves something physically. I wasn't moved physically. I was moved inside. At one moment, I'm on my way to commit suicide, and the next minute, I don't have the compulsion and the obsession. Take a look at your own life. How was the compulsion and the obsession taken? For some people, it seems a more gradual process. But at some point, you're freed from that by the grace of God, by the activity of God. And then he goes on to say, the great fact is just this. All part of this great collage. And then we go on to this more, the chapter more about alcoholism. You know, I'm a teacher, and I think it almost feels to me when we get to this more about alcoholism, he's given us the doctor's opinion, he's given us Bill's story, he's given us there is a solution, and he says, I wonder if they got it. I think I'll write another chapter. I don't know if that's how he did it, but I'm going to give them some examples. And what does he start with? He starts talking about obsession. He starts talking about illusion and delusion. You notice the big book never talks about denial. Never says denial. It talks about how we see. If you remember at the beginning, I said, Eric Butterworth used to say, I'm not here to set it right. I am here to see it right. You see, and when we have an illusion, we do not see correctly. How do you correct an illusion? You know, if you look at the railroad tracks, the illusion is that those two tracks come together, isn't it? How do you correct the illusion? You don't go out there and try and move the tracks. The illusion is in here. The illusion is in the way we see. And, you know, if we keep at it long enough, we come to that place where we can't distinguish the true from the false. And so he goes on with those three stories. I just find these first 50 pages are so rich. They help me really to see what powerlessness is and to convince me, because we've got the businessman after 25 years, he's going to drink again. And he's dead in 4 years. And then we have this wonderful story of Jim. Oh, I love Jim. He's quite a character, isn't he? He used to be quite a prominent man in the community. And he used to have a car dealership. He doesn't have it anymore. He works there now. Ah, this particular morning, he comes to work on Tuesday. I wonder where he was on Monday. And he says, I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. What I love about this, it talks to us. Look at the mental attitude. Look at the stuff that's going on. And if you've had a problem with going out and drinking, look at the stuff. People say, I slipped. You know, I'm not too sure about that. See? He says, I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman, and I had a few words with the boss. I would think that that would be a very good time to call your sponsor. Instead, what does he do? But he says, nothing much, nothing too serious. Honey, words with the boss are always serious. Irritated, being irritated because you're no longer the boss, also very big. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one. Yeah, I'm sure the prospects for a new car lined up in the ditches. Waiting for you, Jim. And then he goes into a bar. Great place to go for lunch, isn't it? When you're irritated and you've had all this stuff going on, you haven't talked to your sponsor, no indication that he's prayed, and before he knows it, he's in big trouble. And whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? And then we get on to this business, you know, and he talks about the curious mental phenomenon that we can be reasonable and also we can be so unreasonable. And he says here, we've been strangely insane. I love this stuff because I can be strangely insane when I think about this legal matter. I can have a strange mental blank spot and just worry it to death, you know, and then go to a meeting and tell somebody how good everything is. And it's in this that he says, self-knowledge won't do it, and fear won't do it. And he says he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. See, I don't think that's an option. I hear people say, I don't meditate. I don't read spiritual literature, you know, whatever. He says, and I'm not saying that's the only way to enlarge our spiritual life, but I think somehow or other, hopefully, we'll get a few ideas about how we can bring the power into our lives. And then I love the story of Fred. You know, the successful guy who goes to Washington and he has a great success and he just blows it. He goes into the bar and he's going to have a cocktail. And he's been talking to the AA boys before, but he's not going to do AA. And he doesn't need AA, and he's going to do it himself. Look how important I am, and look how successful I am. And he gets into a great deal of trouble. And he says, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I carefully went over that evening. Not only had I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatsoever against the first drink. I realized I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. See, I recognize I was irrational in the days when I was drinking. You know, I'm sure you were too, weren't you? You knew you could lose your home. You knew you could lose your family. You knew you could lose all kinds of things. People could stand and cry and say, don't you know how you're hurting us? And out you went anyway. I'm just as irrational today when I think about that thing that's troubling me. So, he goes on to the point where he says, they came to him. He was knocked to his knees. Successful Fred, who's going to Washington to make big deals, he doesn't need God. Or not the way he came to find out. They outlined the spiritual answer and program of action. The program of action was pretty drastic, he says. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. And it's there where he says, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. We're going to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, because time is a wasting. No, it isn't a wasting. We're using it very well, aren't we? Absolutely. See how language gets to us. What I want to really say about step one is this. I think I'll just finish with this. I think the lessons I learned from step one are this. I'm not the boss. If I had my way, I would drink alcohol. You know, going back, I didn't stop drinking because I thought it was a good idea. I stopped drinking because I was going to die if I kept on, and I was on my way to that. The universe doesn't care. See, if I am using the wrong solution, the universe doesn't care. If I'm using the wrong solution, I'm going to get the consequences. See? And so, I think what I have learned from this is, I'm not the boss on the planet. In the book, in How It Works, it says there is one who has all power. And it has never put my name there. Don't understand that. There's one who has all power. You see, I hear people say sometimes the book isn't well put together. And I don't believe that. Because I think it's very well put together. Because when we get to the chapter to the agnostics, if that is correct, that God is everything, then the power of God is in me. And if I'm going to use the power of God for the wrong reasons, there will be consequences, you see? And so I think what I have learned from step one is this, that I'm not the boss here. I'm not the boss about whether I drink or not. What this getting knocked to my knees has done is open me so that I can do what Fred did, that he can see the world in a different way and let this power in. I have come to believe through step one, through everything that I've said, no human power can fix me. I can't fix myself. I'm a guest here. I don't have power of my own. And I have found step one to be the yeast of my life, so to speak. I didn't used to, but as time has gone on, and I have really studied this idea of powerlessness, and I have seen this immense collage in those first 50 pages, it's telling me fear won't keep you sober. Self-knowledge won't keep you sober, and it won't fix your life either. You know, you've been knocked to your knees. Now, let God in. And so I spend time every morning, before I do anything else, thinking about step one. and thinking about my position on the planet, because that's really what I think step one is getting to. You're not the boss here. So get out of yourself. Nobody's here. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, I wonder how Mildred would like me to act today. And I don't think they do that for you either. The world is the world, and it's going on. And if I can understand that I'm part of this, as I finish step one, that's all I know. I'm not the boss here. God hasn't given me a magic wand to say, I don't like her, I'll change her. I sure don't like him, I'll change him, and all that kind of stuff. That's why I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. I never did it right. I never got enough of anything. They never paid enough attention to me. They didn't do what I wanted. They don't today. It's not the way life works, you see. It's that kind of thinking, I believe, that prepares me for the day. And I have to tell you that my day goes in proportion to the dedication that I do to step one. Reminding myself, I'm not the boss here. I am indeed without power of my own to make the world the way I want it to be. And I believe so are you. And if I can remember that, I'm going to run to step two, which is where we'll run tomorrow morning. Are there any questions? I see that it's midnight. My time. Any questions? Yes? No, I don't think so. I think we're left on our own. Is it possible to use your human powers to write 2 plus 2 is 7? Can you write 2 plus 2 is 7? I can. I can pick up a pen and I can write 2 plus 2 is 7. And if I do, there will be consequences. See, there's some questions, you know, I think I'll have to think about that so I give you a decent answer. But I do believe, I think what the philosophers would tell us is that we can write 2 plus 2 is 7, but there will be consequences for not following the truth, if you will, or the way the world is. And that's why I think the whole business of waking up to our spiritual identity is so crucial. Because you can commit murder. See? I know some of the spiritual teachers I've had, the way they would describe that, they would say that that doesn't exist in God's world. It exists in the human world. Anyway, I'll have to think about that some more tonight. Anything else? Yes. Absolutely. And if I forget, I get into trouble. Before I know it, I'm pushing on somebody, and they're pushing back. I just find that when after I started giving retreats, people started asking me to do step work with them. And that's when I start, people would say, what does that mean that I'm powerless? And I began to really explore that word. And I think that it's such a rich word. It, as I look at that whole collage of those first 50 pages, it helps me to understand what it really means. And so if I do step one the way I have described, my day goes a whole lot better. I'm much more easy about the way things go. I'm much more easy about needing to spend 23 hours to get to Alabama and all kinds of things. Things that I would normally have stamped my little foot about and God knows what, and yelled at a few people and think, what could they do about it? It's just my opinion. I love the word, I'm powerless. See, when you look at it, I can't change this legal thing that I'm in. Fred gives me the idea of how I can handle it through spiritual principles. So we'll talk about that tomorrow, because I think that's a big deal. Spiritual principles would solve all my problems. Mental principles, physical principles, earthly principles. You know, we act through those. But I think once we begin to see, truly I am a God being, and if I act that way, things will get taken care of. Okay? Anybody else? Yes. Well, you know what? I go by what Dr. Jung said, that even a good church member will not have the necessary wherewithal to get involved. Why would we get involved if I'm not powerless? If I don't see that I'm helpless? If I don't see that I'm screwed? You know, how to me, an in-depth understanding of where I stand on the planet. I stand on the planet, and I've said this a number of times, and people have questioned me, and they say, how can you say that when you're 37 years sober? And what I say is, I feel vulnerable every day. There's no guarantee. Last Friday, I get to Chicago, to O'Hare, and I'm all set. I'm going to get on a plane to Huntsville, and I'm going to be in Alabama in 3 hours. Instead, I get there 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, you could go on. Isn't it true? The phone rings, and your life changes. You wake up one day, and you've got a lump somewhere. You know, somebody comes to the door, and you find out somebody has died or whatever. I mean, it's endless, endless, endless. Big things, little things, etc. Life just flows, see? And if I can understand that, I live on a planet with 6.8 billion of you, plus animals and plants and insects and God knows what. And they're not all geared to pleasing me. And there you go. Isn't that true? And, you know, the more I think of that, the easier I am. The easier, the more I flow with life. And the better my relationships go, too. You better pay attention, young man. Have I got delights in store for you? Okay. Can we close with, what do you close with here? Do you close with the Our Father? Do you close with the Serenity Prayer? Our Father, let's do it. Okay?